Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care teleconference webcast. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and Lymphoma Research Foundation, and the topic is Update on Lymphoma from the 2016 American Society of Hematology, or ASH, annual meeting. Now, today's program is truly a collaborative venture between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and although we have many other collaborating organizations as well on the call, and because of that collaboration, we have over 750 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Costa Rica, Germany, India, Iran, Italy, New Zealand, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really, this is a bit of a global call, really, from all over the world. It's a credit to all of you that you have chosen this next hour with us. Now, today's program is supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Celgene Corporation, Genentech Bio-Oncology, Biogen IDEC, Seattle Genetics, and Takeda Oncology. And I really want to thank them for support of this important program today. It's one that we have been doing in collaboration with the Lymphoma Research Foundation now for many years, and it's one that I know many of you await, getting really all the information from ASH regarding lymphoma. Now, we have wonderful speakers, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Thomas Haberman. Dr. Haberman is Professor of Medicine, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. And Dr. Haberman is going to address an overview of lymphoma and ASH, disease-specific updates from ASH on indolent and mantle cell lymphoma, and quality of life concerns. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Haberman.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner. And as I start, we hope that you all respect that there are no bad questions so that we are ready for those. We know that you or a loved one have been affected by lymphoma, so please ask questions. Relative to the meeting, there were over 27,000 participants at this very international meeting, and the countries Dr. Messner mentioned, I think, were all represented. There were over 4,799 abstracts presented as oral or poster presentations. I found more than 22 mantle cell, 22 follicular, 4 other low-grade, and 11 pertinent other quality-of-life abstracts that could have been presented today. About what was presented, this is a time of tremendous national and international collaboration and megadata. There were data sets of 14 to 18 clinical trials in the FLASH and SEAL studies, which we will likely review today. The molecular genetic studies are very integrated, and one study looked at large cell lymphoma of 1,001 cases. There were new phase 2 and 3 clinical trial results that were reported that we will review. As a background to lymphoma, there are three messages with regard to classification, overall prognosis, and incidence, which I would like to briefly overview. This summer, the 2016 revision of the World Health Organization classification of lymphoid neoplasms came out. In this, there are 99 listed histologies. Perhaps it's down to 96, but that begins to explain how complicated lymphoma is. The second point is a paper that we had come out last year looking at the National Cancer Database from the United States, and we looked at 600,000 patients, and the trends were that the five-year overall survival rate improved for all except hairy cell leukemia, which we actually reported back in the 90s to have survival out of the normal population, and T-cell non-Hodgkin lymphoma, which is a very complicated disease and likely not differentiated well in this database. When looking at the breakdown of the histologies, 32.5% were diffuse large B-cell, 17% follicular, 8.3% marginal zone, and 4.1% mantle cell. And so our breakdown in our discussion today adequately fits this. So what did we learn and what came out of this meeting in follicular lymphoma? There are two main classes of monoclonal antibodies. Rituximab is a type 1 antibody. We've been waiting for results from type 2 antibodies. And at this meeting, a plenary session paper was presented on obinutuzumab, which reported that chemotherapy-based induction with obinutuzumab with maintenance obinutuzumab prolonged the progression-free survival in patients with previously untreated follicular lymphoma, reporting a 34% reduction in the risk of a progression-free survival event. A very interesting paper came out of the outcomes for patients with follicular lymphoma using an individualized patient data from 5,922 patients in 18 randomized clinical trials in the FLASH study. They looked at patients under the age of 60 versus over the age of 60. And what was really fascinating was that different age groups have similar early disease outcomes. That is, the progression-free survival was clinically similar, and there is no difference in disease progression. And this is of interest not only for individual patients, but for clinical trials. The Memorial Sloan Kettering group looked at their data on bendamustine with anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies, which is really the backbone of how we treat low-grade disease. In previous studies, Rummel and their series in Europe reported infectious complications of 37%. In a study done in the United States by Dr. Flynn and colleagues, it was 55%. But the Memorial group presented that only 20% infectious complications and 6% opportunistic infections. And what they had implemented as a practice guideline change in the midst of this was to use antiviral and anti-pneumocystis prophylaxis along with growth factor in selected patients. And they've adapted a practice guideline to this effect. The whole question of what happens if we observe a patient and what are your long-term outcomes? Again, in a very interesting paper of 246 patients, the time to initial treatment of patients who were observed was 3.6 years. But fascinatingly, the time to second treatment was 12.7 years. So the median time to second treatment was that long and really portends a remarkable good outcome. There was a group that looked at early relapse after looking at different rituximab doublets with looking at galixumab, epertuzumab, and lenalidomide. And of those patients were followed. The five-year overall survival rate was 76% if one did progress, but 99% if one didn't. I think the real important message here is that the outcomes are remarkably good and portend well for our future and studies as we're looking into this disease. Different groups and in different tumors have been interested in vitamin D insufficiency, and our group reported an increased risk of clinical failure in follicular lymphoma, as 19% of patients were deficient and the outcomes were not as favorable. Whether treating patients with vitamin D improves outcomes warrants further assessment, but this is really an interesting, different thought and potential approach to looking at these diseases. Ibrutinib as treatment for chemoimmunotherapy-resistant patients was reported in the DAWN study in 110 patients, and as a single agent, the overall response rate was in the 20% range. When the MD Anderson group reported ibrutinib combined with rituximab in treatment-naive patients, the overall response rates were 85 and 75%. What was a very interesting paper was the long-term results of the R-CHOP versus CHOP I-131 tocetuzumab study by the Southwestern Oncology Group. And interestingly, at 10 years, almost half the patients remained disease-free. My concern at this time is that patients can feel like they may not have been adequately treated if they didn't receive newer agents, but this should provide a tremendous amount of hope. A question that many patients have is, what happens if I relapse with follicular lymphoma? We know that's part of the natural history. In a paper of 1,134 patients, the median progression-free survival was 4.8 years after the first line and 1.6 years after the second line. Venetoclax was looked at with reported with rituximab and then with bendamustine rituximab, and the complete remission rates went from 14% up to 50%, with overall response rates in refractory patients of 33%, adding a new agent. Idelalisib was reported in responses of over 50% in relapsed refractory patients. Well, what about mantle cell lymphoma? Mantle cell lymphoma, as many know, is a very complicated disease in its management, and there were a couple of very interesting, important observations at this year's meeting. The first was rituximab maintenance after auto stem cell transplant. The LISA group reported a prolonged survival in younger patients with mantle cell lymphoma, with an improvement in the 4-year overall survival and event-free and progression-free survival post-transplant. A meta-analysis was performed on 6 trials, which reported improved progression-free survival with rituximab maintenance in mantle cell lymphoma. Well, what happens if you're observed with mantle cell lymphoma? This question is out there in a series from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Group of 404 patients. 91 patients were observed, and interestingly, they reported a superior overall survival for patients who were observed versus those who were treated, and a median time to treatment of 23 months. And I think this should be reassuring to those physicians who observe patients and to those patients who are observed. Lenalidomide after progression and relapse after ibrutinib, response rates were reported to be 27%, and this is an encouraging result and consistent with other regimens. Molecular monitoring has become very important in mantle cell lymphoma, and there are multiple papers on this. A study from the MCL2 and MCL3 European studies revealed that minimal residual disease negative patients had an overall survival that was longer. What about new drugs in mantle cell lymphoma? The Weill Cornell group reported on ibrutinib and palbociclib, which is a CDK4/6 inhibitor and an oral agent, and reported an overall response rate of 67%. And this is a very fascinating and important biology and will likely be important in other lymphomas. There were other phase 2 trials reported in mantle cell lymphoma multiple, and I won't go through those. The Charlson Comorbidity Index was looked at along with the MIPI in mantle cell lymphoma, and what was really fascinating is that patients who had a morbidity index of 0 to 3 at 5 years, the overall survival was 90%. And I think this should aid us in our future approaches. Well, what about quality of life? There was a large paper of 11,000 patients looking at the SEER database linked to Medicare claims in patients who survived 2 years with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And certainly patients develop issues in their health care, such as cardiovascular disease, congestive heart failure, and other malignancies, but the outcomes higher in patients who were treated with chemotherapy, but the outcomes weren't terribly worse, which was really interesting, and I think really points out the importance of close long-term follow-up for patients who are over the age of any patients, but especially over the age of 67. There's really an interesting article on patterns of cutaneous malignancy among survivors of non-Hodgkin lymphoma looking at the SEER database by Lindsay Morton at the NCI. And what is reassuring in this group of diseases is the risk is quite low in follicular lymphoma and marginal zone lymphoma. So with that, that gives you some highlights of the meeting, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Haberman. That was really outstanding and just a wonderful introduction to the whole call and also such a wonderful overview of a lot of the key issues that were addressed at the ASH meeting. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Leo Gordon. Dr. Gordon is Abby and John Friend Professor of Cancer Research, Professor in Medicine, Director, Lymphoma Program. He's also co-director, Hematologic Malignancies Program, Division of Hematology Oncology, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of Northwestern University. And he's also medical director of the John and Lillian Matthews Center for Cellular Therapy. And Dr. Gordon is going to be addressing disease-specific updates on aggressive and Hodgkin lymphoma, the role of clinical trials and translational research, and talking with your healthcare team about your treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Gordon.
Carolyn, thanks very much, and thank you, Tom, for that introduction. So Tom has already told you how extensive the meeting was and the number of abstracts. I'm going to focus on two diseases, really, aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphomas and Hodgkin's lymphoma, and talk a little bit about clinical trials and also talk a little bit about what you should do to sort of get involved in clinical trials, how you talk to your healthcare provider about your general care and also about some novel treatment options. What we noticed from this meeting were some themes, and I'll talk about both the aggressive lymphomas and Hodgkin's lymphoma in terms of those themes. One was just a theme was just sort of prognostic factors and looking to predict outcomes, looking at big databases to get a sense of what we thought was true and kind of prove that is true and how the survival and the outcome of patients with various types of lymphoma has improved. The other theme that went through the meeting was the whole theme of immunotherapy, and we can divide that into pills or actually antibodies that are given, the so-called checkpoint inhibitors, which help to take the brakes off our immune system so that our immune system can be more active in attacking lymphoma, and also as a form of immunotherapy, a way to manipulate our T cells outside of the body and then re-inject them in so they become the attackers against certain types of lymphoma. I'll start with the aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I think Tom alluded to some large studies. This was actually a Mayo Clinic database study, the so-called SEAL database, looking, and this is done through the Mayo Clinic, actually, and through their SPORE program by Maurer et al., presented data in almost 18,000 patients were reviewed and looked at what happens if people remain in remission at 24 months. And the key point to this with this large number of patients that if you're in remission for 24 months with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and aggressive lymphoma, your overall survival was almost identical to that of the general population at about 7 years. So really exciting, important data that tells us the importance of achieving remission. The other studies that were presented, there were a couple of studies presented on PET scan and the usefulness of PET scan, and there were two themes to that. One is that we use the PET scan to tell whether there's disease or not, but we can also use the initial PET scan as a way of measuring tumor metabolism, something called tumor glycolysis, how quickly the tumor utilizes glucose, and also measuring in a more specific way the tumor volume. And it turns out that there are now predictors that are available to us to determine whether someone is going to have a more aggressive course or a less aggressive course based upon how their tumor metabolizes the radioactive glucose that's given when you have a PET scan. The other important PET scan study in aggressive lymphoma was that it turns out that the interim PET scan, the one that we use pretty routinely now for Hodgkin's lymphoma after, say, two or three cycles to make sure we're on the right track, there was some debate about whether that was useful in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in the aggressive lymphomas. And it turns out that probably is also useful. The problem is if the PET scan isn't where we want it to be, what should we do to change the outcome, to change those outcomes? So I think we're seeing now the better use of imaging techniques such as PET scan and better way to use them in the aggressive lymphomas. There were a number of presentations on the so-called chimeric antigen receptor T cell, or CAR, C-A-R, T cell therapy that's been studied now really for about 10 years, developed by a number of people, Stan Riddell in Seattle and Carl June in Philadelphia and other investigators, and Dr. Allison, who's currently in Texas, who recognized that our T cells are normally turned off. It's the body's way of protecting us against autoimmune diseases. So we want our T cells not to be too aggressive. But when we're facing a malignancy, when we're facing a lymphoma, we want those T cells to be active. And there are now ways that you can take patients' T cells out of the body, and similar to the way that you collect them for a stem cell transplant, and manipulate them, manipulate those T cells using viruses and inserting certain genes into those cells. And those genes now recognize the lymphoma cells as being foreign entities. And so there are a number of studies presented. There are studies being done through Juno Therapeutics and Kite and Novartis that suggest that patients with otherwise very aggressive lymphomas that have progressed on prior therapies get fairly dramatic responses, with complete response rates of over 50 or 60% and overall response rates of 70 or 80%. There are still some toxicities that need to be worked out, but these data are very promising. Only small numbers of patients have been treated so far, and the follow-up is still short, but they're extremely important and encouraging trials that are ongoing. There were a couple of other studies looking, an important study, looking at comparison with a standard regimen, R-CHOP, compared to a more novel regimen, EPOC, dose-adjusted EPOC, that was popularized at the National Cancer Institute. And those studies actually, in large numbers of patients, suggested that both groups do well and that there's no clear advantage of one versus the other. There are a couple of presentations on central nervous system lymphoma, and very importantly, that the drug ibrutinib, which is used in chronic lymphocytic leukemia and mantle cell lymphoma, looks like it has activity in aggressive lymphomas that are in the central nervous system, because that drug, and we didn't know this before, gets into the central nervous system and gives us high responses. Other important studies are looking at the addition of the drug Revlimid or lenalidomide to the standard R-CHOP regimen, and it looks like that may be advantageous for certain types of a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And there's also some studies suggesting that lenalidomide might also get into the central nervous system and be important for central nervous system lymphomas. Turn to Hodgkin's lymphoma, where we've done more studies on the so-called checkpoint inhibitors. There are one that's already approved, nivolumab, made by Bristol-Myers, and pembrolizumab, made by Merck, is still in clinical trials. And it looks as though in patients who have had Hodgkin's, and again, we're doing very well with Hodgkin's with standard therapy, but there's a group of maybe 20% of patients that still have need for further treatment. And these so-called checkpoint inhibitors, which takes the brakes off of the immune system, lead to very dramatic responses, complete responses, in a significant number of patients, and these responses appear to be lasting. The question now is whether these new drugs will be a replacement for transplant or a bridge to transplant in those patients who couldn't get to that point otherwise. So those are, I think, very key studies in Hodgkin's lymphoma. One looked at the combination of nivolumab and the drug brentuximab. This is a study that Alex Herrera from City of Hope presented, looking at fairly high response rates, overall response rates of 100%, and complete remissions in half the patients. And those patients were able to then go on to stem cell transplant. Catherine Diefenbach for the ECOG group looked at combinations of ipilimumab, which is another checkpoint inhibitor, nivolumab, the one that's been recently approved, and brentuximab, the drug that's already been approved for the treatment of Hodgkin's lymphoma. And these are in patients that have already had a transplant but unfortunately had a recurrence. Again, we're seeing overall response rates of 100%, complete response rates of about 60 to 65%, and really striking numbers and generally well-tolerated therapies. This has really changed the outlook in patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma, that group of patients that need more treatment. And finally, Craig Moskowitz presented data from the so-called KEYNOTE trial using pembrolizumab, similar data to the other studies, and then John Timmerman updated data that have already been published looking at these same checkpoint inhibitors showing even better complete responses and longer lasting complete responses. So quite exciting time in Hodgkin's lymphoma and in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. This at this point, you've heard that there are these great advances, and you've heard that patients are getting responses to diseases where they weren't seeing responses before. How did they get there, and how did we find these data? This is all through the use of novel clinical trials where patients participate in these trials because they understand that they then have access to new treatments that no one else has access to. These treatments not only help the patients that are on the trials, but they're going to help future patients. They're going to help neighbors. They're going to help people that may eventually not be in a clinical trial, but these drugs will become approved and they'll be available for use for everyone. So it's really important to understand that all of the advances that we make in oncology, not just in the hematologic malignancies, but in other malignancies as well, are just ideas, good ideas, many of them, in the laboratory of investigators and scientists, but they really become reality when they're applied to people. And the only way that these new agents can be applied to people is through the use of well-conducted, well-designed, carefully controlled clinical trials where patient safety and patient outcomes are the main focus of these trials. So I think that's extremely important. And how do you go about? Patients aren't always at major centers where they have ready access to the trials and the trials are stressed. How do you go about getting access to some of these newer agents? I think it's clear that as you're seen by your oncologist, whether they're a specialist in lymphomas or not a specialist in lymphomas, your doctor has access to the National Cancer Comprehensive Cancer Center guidelines, the NCCN guidelines, which we've worked on for years and updated two or three times a year so that the physicians know what the latest therapies are. They also will know where the latest clinical trials are. And I think it's perfectly legitimate for you to talk to your physician about novel trials and about having access to some of these newer agents. And I think it's something that patients really should get used to doing, and physicians should expect that their patients are going to be asking about these questions. So, really, this is a wonderful era in lymphoma. The results of this meeting just reinforce that. That's something that we already strongly suspected, and I suspect that as time moves along, we're going to see further and further improvements presented at the ASH meetings next year, the ASCO meetings next year, and Lugano meetings in 2017. So I'll stop here and turn this back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gordon. That was really outstanding and very, very informative. I can see questions are coming in already online before we've been given people instructions, so I know there'll be lots of questions during the Q&A for both both Dr. Haberman and Dr. Gordon, for both of you. So thank you. And our next presenter is Mr. Maxwell Mulcahy. And Ms. Mulcahy is Senior Director of Patient and Professional Programs, Lymphoma Research Foundation. He has really been the architect of today's program, really helping to both identify the best speakers for today's program, which we really have the best of the best, and also in helping to really get support for the program today so that it was possible. So hats off to Mr. Mulcahy. And Mr. Mulcahy is going to address the Lymphoma Research Foundation's free programs and conferences and the Lymphoma Research Foundation's helpline. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Mr. Mulcahy.
Great. Thank you very much, Carolyn, and to Cancer Care for our continued partnership. I would also like to thank our esteemed faculty, Dr. Leo Gordon from Northwestern University, who's also the chair of the Lymphoma Research Foundation Scientific Advisory Board, and, of course, Dr. Thomas Haberman from Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Haberman is the Scientific Advisory Board Chair-elect. So thank you very much to both of you for sharing your time and your expertise today, and, of course, everything you do to support the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And I would also like to acknowledge our corporate partners, Celgene, Genentech and Biogen, Seattle Genetics, and Takeda Oncology for supporting today's call. And last but not least, of course, I would like to thank each of you for joining us on this teleconference. As some of you may know, the Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted to funding innovative research and serving the lymphoma and CLL community. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. And we achieve this mission through providing comprehensive education programs, outreach initiatives, and patient services. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying potentially life-saving therapies for lymphoma and CLL through our aggressively funded research program that is guided by LRF's scientific leadership, who are among the leaders in lymphoma research across the world. And LRF invests millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and has played a key role in accelerating the understanding and treatment of all lymphoma subtypes. And to date, LRF has funded nearly $60 million in lymphoma-specific research. And the American Society of Hematology Conference is the premier venue where researchers discuss and share key findings in the advancement of lymphoma therapies. To that end, I'm very pleased to share that many of the LRF Scientific Advisory Board members and grantees contributed greatly to the sessions that were hosted at this conference. Over 300 of the lymphoma abstracts featured LRF Scientific Advisory Board members, past and present, as well as over 40 oral presentations, and approximately 400 abstracts featured LRF grantees and scholars, as well as 80 oral presentations by grantees and scholars. And I also know that several of the featured abstracts and these oral presentations were directly funded by Lymphoma Research Foundation research dollars. So to learn more about our research program and to view the extensive list of our scientific advisory board, please visit lymphoma.org/research. And Dr. Leo Gordon did talk about some of the trials and studies going on by many of these individuals. The foundation remains committed, of course, to providing comprehensive disease-specific resources, programs, and services to those who have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. And some of these resources include the Lymphoma Helpline, where our professionally trained staff assist you with your search for disease and treatment information and resources and other services. We have a clinical trials information service, which provides information about clinical trials, and then we do legwork to help identify a trial that is appropriate for your diagnosis and in your geographic area. And we have a lymphoma support network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that pairs lymphoma patients and caregivers with others who have had a similar lymphoma experience. And, of course, there is our Focus on Lymphoma, our mobile app, which allows users to record doctor sessions, manage medications, track blood work, and document treatment side effects. And this is available for free download in the Apple App Store and Google Play, so I encourage everyone to download the app today. I hope you take advantage of all these terrific resources and services. For more information about our programs and services resources, you can always contact the LRF helpline, and you can call toll-free at 800-500-9976, and you can visit our website, of course, at www.lymphoma.org. Thank you very much, and I will give it back to Carolyn.
Thank you so much, Max. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. And just a wonderful, actually, concept that the Lymphoma Research Foundation provides a host of services to all of you that Max has so eloquently described, and also is really funding significant research that really makes such a difference in all of your lives. So that's a very important dual organizational mission that they have. It's really incredible. So we're delighted to work with you and continue. This has been a very long-term partnership. It's been over, I think, 18 years and growing. So there you have it. I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care, and then we're going to take questions. So I just want to say that Cancer Care is a national organization. It's a nonprofit. And we provide really psychosocial support to people living with all cancers and, of course, with all lymphomas as well. And we have a staff of oncology social workers who are here to provide practical and financial assistance and also to provide counseling services, really that fancy word for saying that someone that you can talk to about some of your concerns and troubles that might be of worry to you. And you can talk with someone on the telephone or online. And you can do that around any type of issue that you might be concerned about. And also, we do have telephone support groups and online support groups. And for those of us, the international participants, and also people in different parts of the country, many people appreciate the online groups because you can post anytime you want, and they will be responded to. Our staff will respond to the post, and the members of the group will respond as well. So it's a wonderful way to keep in touch with each other, and people find that very helpful as well. We also offer many workshops like this one on different topics, and we also have many publications and, of course, a website. To contact Cancer Care, you can simply call 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website, and you have all those materials, and you'll be getting all these materials after the program as well with the evaluation, with really just all these resources as well. So with all that being said, we now want to be able to take questions. So I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and if Stephanie would explain to you how to queue up for questions, we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question by the end of the program today, then I will actually give you resources to get your questions answered. So please stay tuned, stay on, and we have about a full half hour for questions. So let's see, we're going to try to do the best we very much can in terms of answering your questions. So Stephanie, could you bring all of the speakers on board and explain how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Our first question comes from Carol M. Your line is open.
Hi. I think this is who you want to speak to, but I basically received rituximab and had a total anaphylaxis on it. And I applied to Denmark and got some Humac CD20, which is ofatumab or whatever. But I was wondering, with this CAR T cell therapy, is it made chimeric with mouse? Because obviously I'm allergic to mouse. Is there other animals they can make this system with, or is there a human form of it, just like with Humac CD20? Or I don't know if
right. So,
Carol, and also, do you want to identify your type of lymphoma? Just so
I have follicular lymphoma.
Excellent. And yes.
This is Dr. Gordon. I can probably, since I mentioned the CAR T, so the chimeric antigen receptor refers to a different kind of chimera than that you see with antibodies. The chimeric antibodies are part mouse, part human, and that's correct. Those are proteins. These are genes that are inserted into the T cells through viruses, and so while there are side effects to these agents, it's not the kind of anaphylaxis that you would see. So having anaphylaxis to Rituxan wouldn't predict anaphylaxis to the CAR T cells. And follicular lymphoma, we're only now just starting some studies with these CAR T cells and follicular lymphoma. Up till now, it's been the more aggressive, the large cell lymphomas. But I think you're okay for chimeric antigen receptor T cell from that standpoint. There are other side effects that obviously need to be worked out. But so I don't know if that answers your question.
Excellent. Thank you. Dr. Haberman, did you want to comment as well? Or?
No, the early response rates, last year's meeting, they reported out of the Penn group, 7 out of 7 responses, partial and complete included. So there is activity. This, in follicular lymphoma, this will be for a small select group of patients in all likelihood, because the well over 75 to 80% of patients with follicular lymphoma can be managed in multiple other ways that would not be fraught with similar toxicities, especially the central nervous system and other toxicities of CAR T cell therapy.
We have a question. Thank you very much. And we have a question from one of our online participants. At what point is it appropriate to initiate treatment in the lymphocytic leukemia and small lymphocytic lymphoma? Dr. Haberman, could you address that question?
So that's a very complicated question, and in part related to FISH studies, in part related to other molecular studies, in part related to the bulkiness of the lymphadenopathy, and lastly, symptoms. So certainly in symptomatic patients with bulky disease, the initiation of therapy up front is routine internationally. After that, it comes down to also if there's an unfavorable FISH study, an abnormality of chromosome 17 would move many different sites, investigators involved in SLL, CLL, to consider intervening therapeutically, especially with a drug called ibrutinib.
Thank you. And our next telephone question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Ron R. Your line is open.
Hello. First of all, thank you very much for an informative teleconference. I have a question about follicular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And if a patient is in remission, of course the healthcare provider, the doctor, will be look for infectious complications that might come up. But what can the patient also look for? Are these always pulmonary, or are there other directions that infectious complications might take that should be looked at?
Infections are the primary complications with therapeutic intervention with follicular lymphoma. There are other rare complications such as progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, which is a virus of the central nervous system. There, in general, as a general rule, and I'll ask Dr. Gordon to also make a comment. Unless you've been on long-term maintenance therapy with follicular lymphoma and you're not on treatment and you've not undergone an allogeneic transplant, and maybe a couple of other exceptions, infectious complications are not a major issue unless there's very relapsed refractory disease with very low blood counts.
Right. Yeah, thanks, Tom. I would agree with that. I think that we see infections in people that are on long-term maintenance rituximab, and those are usually associated with low gamma globulin levels and present in the sinuses and as bronchitis. And if there's a need for long-term maintenance, that those can be managed sometimes with gamma globulin infusions. The other area of infections that I would, and I think Dr. Haberman alluded to this earlier, is that some of the trials using bendamustine and some of the other drugs that do suppress the immune system, we do see a higher risk of certain types of infections. And many patients, we've been giving preventive or prophylactic antibiotics to those patients. So, but it's really the patients that are on treatment where the infection risk is higher. Patients just being observed, in general, the risk is really not too much different than the general population, I think.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question is from one of our online participants. And I'm going to address this question to Dr. Gordon. Anything new on transformed relapsed refractory lymphomas, including predictors and treatment?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think we're learning that some of the transformed lymphomas, when we look at the molecular abnormalities, fall into the category of the so-called double hit lymphomas, where you do have a mutation of the gene c-MYC, M-Y-C, and you have a mutation of either the gene BCL2 or BCL6. And those tend to have a somewhat more aggressive course and have maybe led to the not-so-good outcomes that we think about when we think of transformed lymphomas. But not all of the transformed follicular to diffuse large B-cell lymphomas are double hit. And they still respond fairly well to more standard aggressive therapy, assuming that there hasn't been a lot of prior therapies. I will say there's one abstract that presented studies that were done with Takeda that we did here at Northwestern, looking at an oral drug that inhibits the protein called SYK, S-Y-K, and we're seeing some very good responses both in transformed and non-transformed diffuse large B-cell lymphomas, anywhere from maybe 50% responses in very heavily pretreated patients with a oral, relatively non-toxic drug. So I think there's some new agents that are being looked at in that disease, and I think people are just beginning to understand the pathology and the biology of transformation, and maybe we'll start to figure out ways to predict it a little bit better than we've been able to do, because it does come out of the blue sometimes, and we have to be able to predict it better.
And Dr. Haberman, did you want to add anything? Or?
Well, I agree with everything Dr. Gordon said. I had the privilege of presenting our double hit data in an oral session this year. And one of the things we were struck with is how poorly the follicular lymphoma double hit performed, with about 11% long-term good outcomes. There's another paper which suggested it's not quite as bad, but most others suggest that it definitely is inferior. We did report our experience in 2014 out of our SPORE grant. And of interest, if you receive rituximab for your follicular lymphoma, there's a suggestion that we might be decreasing the risk of transformation down from 3% per year down to 2% per year, which in the long run is not insignificant. And we also observed that the patients who hadn't had previous treatment seemed to do as well if treated with rituximab with anthracycline-based chemotherapy as we might have expected otherwise in de novo patients. So some of the landscape has changed significantly, and I agree with Dr. Gordon. I think that hopefully with our different genomic studies, we'll be able to tease out who is who much better and perhaps tailor therapy in that direction.
Thank you. And we have really quite a lot of questions. This is an enormous, this is a wonderful audience, I must say. Great, great questions. So the next question is from our online participants. I'm going to ask Dr. Haberman if you could address this. What is the risk of patients with primary congenital immunodeficiency to develop lymphoma, especially follicular lymphoma? A general question.
The primary congenital immunodeficiency disorders are extremely complicated and rare. For the most part, most patients, at least that I've managed and that you read about in different venues, have more aggressive histology than low-grade histology. Certainly some can, but there's so few patients treated with this, and maybe Dr. Gordon knows of some different references and data, but that is really a rare situation.
Right. We've seen occasional marginal zone lymphomas in patients with chronic immunodeficiency. We've seen, but mostly it's been the low-grade lymphomas that occur, and the mechanism for that isn't clear, the biology isn't clear, but I think it's something that should be watched in people with chronic immunodeficiency, because they do get lung infiltrates, they get pneumonias, and some of those if you look carefully, may turn out to be an early presentation of an extranodal type lymphomas. But I think in general, it's still a rare occurrence.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question for our online participants for Dr. Haberman. What is the optional frequency and duration of rituximab therapy following bendamustine rituximab treatment for mantle cell? Is this optional or optimal? It may be a typo here.
Okay. It's a very interesting and good question. First of all, there's not upfront good randomized data using bendamustine rituximab followed by rituximab maintenance to suggest what we should do. There was a paper from Europe which suggested that there were improved outcomes after an approach with anthracycline-based chemotherapy programs and followed with maintenance rituximab. In our own Western guidelines, we have moved to patients who are not transplant eligible and who are not eligible for other therapeutic options to really consider the use of rituximab in mantle cell lymphoma. But again, there's not good data to suggest that this is efficacious at this time. There are some ongoing studies. Some of them are small and unfortunately not designed to really address the answer to this question.
I can add maybe if you like to also, I agree with Tom, we've also done maintenance following bendamustine and rituximab and mantle cell. And there was a presentation at the recent ASCO meeting by the group in Germany that suggested there was no advantage to that. But they really didn't look at patients who were in complete remission. Most of the patients in their study were not in complete remission. And it's not surprising that there may not be an advantage to maintenance rituximab for those patients not in complete remission. That only made up about 30 to 35% of patients. So if you have somebody that's in complete remission by PET scan, certainly extrapolating from the data on the transplant maintenance in mantle cell, I think you could argue very strongly that there's a rationale for maintenance therapy in mantle cell, even following bendamustine rituximab.
Yeah, and I agree with Leo. And the other problem with the Rummel study is that it was the numbers unfortunately are small, and the study was won't be able to answer this question for us probably long term, unfortunately.
And our next, thank you very much. That's really excellent and really giving a good perspective on everything. So thank you. And our next question, Stephanie, from our telephone participant.
Our next question comes from Joan C. Your line is open. Joan, if your line is on mute, can you please unmute it? Okay, we'll move on to our next question. Our next question comes from Patty D. Your line is open.
Yes, in the increases in transformed lymphoma for follicular, you said 2 or 3%. It was my understanding that it would increase annually as you survived. Is that still true, or have there been new findings?
Thank you for that question, Patty. Dr. Gordon, could you address that question?
Yeah, I think we're still seeing 2 to 3%. I think Tom mentioned that in their study, if you had rituximab as your first treatment, that went from 3% to 2%, so which is not insignificant over many years. I mean, the reality is most patients don't actually have transformation, but it's still something that that we see not infrequently. I think the data still at about 3% a year are still valid, I think, unless Dr. Haberman has some other data, perhaps.
No, I think We've been really intrigued, and no one has put forth some other papers to suggest that rituximab might not be decreasing that incidence potentially. And then the whole question is there a point, for instance, year 15, where that more plateaus off? If you look at some of the pre-rituximab era curves, the curve tends to just keep rising, but not quite at the same rate. But there is that long term risk. Now, whether or not that's going to change in the immunochemotherapy era and then the era of other different agents, it's just not known.
Excellent. And we have another question for one of our online participants. And I'm going to address this question to Dr. Haberman. Was there anything particular at ASH regarding immunotherapies and peripheral T cells? Also curious about thoughts regarding treatment with PD-1 inhibitors on patients without PD-1 expression.
That's a great question.
Great question.
Dr. Gordon,
really wonderful
help me answer
question.
This one. As far as... I guess I wasn't impressed that there was new data on peripheral T-cell NOS, non-Hodgkin lymphoma,
right.
that there's certainly these things are they're ongoing studies, people looking at them with some other approaches, the CAR T cell approaches, but and I'm not aware of significant PD-1 inhibitor data in this arena.
Right, I agree. I mean, I think the one group that might you might expect to have responses is are the angioblastic lymphomas, the angioblastic T cell lymphomas. They do express PD-1, and one might suggest that they may be responsive to the PD-1 inhibitors. In terms of patients responding that don't express PD-L1, that's the ligand for PD-1, remember that the two ways these things work, one is to activate the T cell, so you may not actually even need expression in order to get a good response, but it seems like the best responses are in Hodgkin's, where the common genetic abnormality allows overexpression of PD-L1. The same is true in mediastinal B-cell lymphoma, where the responses are also seen. So it tends to be more in Hodgkin's and in primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma where these drugs are working. In follicular and in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, the results haven't been quite as good. We did a trial with a number of years ago with pitolizumab, which we thought was a PD-1 inhibitor, probably works a little bit differently, and that was in patients with large cell lymphoma who had a transplant and then received this drug as a consolidation, and we observed a 20 to 25% reduction in the expected recurrence rate. Now, this wasn't a randomized study, so that's always the caveat when you don't have a randomized study. So I think that there may still be a role, but most of the data for the PD-1 inhibitors have come in Hodgkin's lymphoma and primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma.
We did have an update on pembrolizumab in Richter transformation.
Yeah.
Wei Ding from our group published this, initially reported it in the papers in process of submission, which interestingly, four or five patients had a response with Richter's transformation, which is, I realize this doesn't relate to the T-cell question, but since there were other questions, so it's interesting. I guess it's interesting.
And there is a question which actually I'm going to ask both Dr. Gordon and Dr. Haberman to address as well. And it's a question really for non-Americans who want to access these novel trials. Particularly the question was for Canadians, but we do have many people from all over the world. So I know that ASH is an international meeting, but the question is the access in each country. Dr. Haberman, would you want to start with that question just to address it in a general way?
I just led a site visit team to the British Columbia Cancer Agency, a big, large grant that was funded, and they have a very significant number of trials and do collaborate with individuals outside of BCA nationally in Canada. And so there are different opportunities at different sites. Secondly, from an international perspective, by individual countries and centers, the opportunities are very variable. I think there's no question that studies are now becoming very international. If you want to do a large study of 1,000 patients, it's very important that it be done in a timely fashion. And so these things are improving, but hopefully the physician you're seeing or the resources that you might have in your country of access can help you find within your own country other opportunities. And whether that be, you know, by each of our borders, I know a number of individuals in Mexico, and they're doing some very interesting work. And so I think the world is changing in that regard.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Gordon, did you want to add to that? Or?
I think I would say is similar that, I mean, if you look at European countries, certainly most of the research that's done in, say, Hodgkin's really came from Germany and France and England. So European countries are well covered with their own large, novel clinical trials. Similarly, as Tom alluded to, Canada has very innovative, both basic and clinical research. If one is looking for a specific clinical trial, say a CAR-T trial, for example, that is not necessarily available in your home country, for the trial, that's probably okay. There needs to be follow-up, and people have to find a way to get back and forth for follow-up for the trial. But the one caveat there is the cost of the sort of non-trial, non-covered costs that might occur. And if people don't have insurance in the U.S., that can be a problem. And so they'd have to sort of work it out with the institution that they're going to have discounts on general care, which would be necessary if you're going to be on a fairly involved trial, like, for example, the CAR-T trials. So, I mean, I think in general, trials are available across globally. There may be some specific ones that might be harder to get to, but again, talking to your physician and your physician talking to the investigator in the trial is probably the best way to go about doing that.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank our speakers. You've really all been outstanding. So thank you all. This has been a really great call and a great tour de force in terms of taking lots of questions. Now, I know that some of you didn't get your questions answered, so I just want to kind of give you, first of all, how to get your questions answered if you didn't get to ask a question. So the first thing I would recommend, first of all, if you have a medically focused question, to please go ahead and call the Lymphoma Research Foundation at 1-800-500-9976. It's a wonderful resource for questions that you did not get to ask here. They certainly would be able to help you. Of course, your healthcare team, we don't want to leave them out either, because we want you to go back to your healthcare team with anything you've learned today. We hope you've learned a lot of things, and ask them the questions as they apply to you, because they know the most about you. And the other resource in terms of any other medical questions would be the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. And you'll be getting all that information from us again in the follow-up to this call, and their evaluation will have all these resources for you. Now, in addition, if you wanted to get some practical financial assistance or counseling services, or sign up for some future programs or publications, you can either contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. But I also have to say the Lymphoma Research Foundation also has wonderful materials for you as well. And so you would contact them as well, 1-800-500-9976. This is truly a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care. So really utilize both organizations for any kind of questions or issues you may have. But your medically focused questions are best addressed by the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Now, with all that being said, we want to thank all of you for being on this call today. I have to say that our speakers were fantastic, but I have to say your questions were really amazing questions and wonderful questions. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening. And I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning this program, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And with that in mind, please do take advantage of all of your follow-up with both the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and of course with your own healthcare team, because your own treating healthcare team knows the most about you and knows the most about each of your particular needs and in terms of your medical questions and things like that. So thank you all for being on the call today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.